Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 168 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
What's been happening since, I think it's about 6 weeks since we last recorded, I think. What have we been up to? Has anything exciting been happening in your life, Hayden?
Another year older, so I'm fast catching up with you two.
I took part in a competition and won some money.
I won a prize. And I decided that I was going to put the money from said prize towards the Season 22 box set.
Oh, right. What did you have to do?
You know, go on Amazon, search Season 22, add to basket.
And another different question. What did you have to do in order to win the prize?
I did a survey. It was one of those ones where you do a survey and you win
£20. Win a free pizza for a year or something.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
I keep going on that and I never win the bloody thing.
Yeah, and it actually arrived earlier today. First thing that I gravitated to was the Affix with Sontarans short. Because I wanted to see... Well, yeah, because obviously they've edited said paedophile out. And they've got Colin Baker, Janet Fielding, and... also including Gareth Jenkins, who was the little boy in the skit.
It's only about 7 or 8 minutes long. It's really nice.
I was quite pleased I gravitated to that. And then I also watched the Two Doctors documentary about them filming in Seville. I forgot what it was called now. It was the Spanish translation of The Feast of Evil, I think the documentary is called. I kind of get the feeling that was the last time they had a wonderful time during the Colin Baker era, unfortunately, because I think it was just after that JNT had them rehearsing for Time Lash and his pantomime at the same time. But it was quite nice, and it was... I mean, it's obviously an era I don't look that fondly upon, but I thought, well, you know, if I can get it for, like, half price, then why not? I shall do such a thing. But I did also purchase 3 of the new Target books as well.
Oh, right, which ones are these?
Well, they've released The Eaters of Light by Ronan Monro.
Oh, yeah.
David Fisher's The Androids of Tara.
Oh.
Stones of Blood. Sorry, was it The Power of Kroll? I can't remember which one it was now. I haven't got those ones, but the ones I went to was The Fires of Pompeii by James Moran, which made it into my top 5 Tenant episodes. And I also got I got The Crimson Horror and Dalek.
But it isn't a collection I'm going to make. It's just stories I like, and I want to see how they're represented in novel form.
So sorry, Mar, but when they re-release Horns of Nymon, I think I might skip that one.
Fancy that.
But it was a nice little haul.
Mark has been doing more than any of us in that he's finally completed his house move.
I have been to Beijing opening up pork markets. No, I haven't. Terrible bang to the head. Sorry.
What?
Did you not get that, Doc?
No, I didn't get that. What does it mean?
Liz Truss talked to a Tory convention a few years ago, and one of the famous... It is famous. Have you heard of it, Hayden?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, one of the famous clips of her from it is of her saying, "And I've been in Beijing opening up pork markets." And then she does this inane grin. And then there's silence for a couple of seconds until some people sort of start embarrassedly clapping. But it's just pork markets has become her calling card. I'm surprised you haven't heard that. But it's topical. I mean, it is now. It might not be by the time the podcast comes out.
In December, I'll be in Beijing opening up new pork markets.
I saw a tweet earlier which did make me laugh. It said, Liz Truss, the greatest over-promotion in British politics since they made Baldrick a lord. Somebody also pointed out her, I think she was in a magazine where she answered a few questions like, oh, what's your favourite? And what was the last record you bought? And she'd written down Onker's Big Mocker by Toploader, and the person who wrote the tweet just put, we're doomed.
Well, that's good to say. We could end up with a Prime Minister who always believed in Remain, but switched at the very last minute because they thought that that was the best way to achieve power. I'm not sure if we'll even notice there's been a change, will we?
No, that's true.
But seriously, guys, I have finally, after years where I've not going to go into details, but it's been quite a stressful few years, and I found myself in some quite difficult places with some unpleasant people, housing-wise. And finally, I have found a home that is safe, it is sound, it is lovely, and I'm very happy here. So, and I'm in a little bungalow in the Kentish countryside, just a few miles south of Slut's Hole.
Not off.
Not off, mate.
How long do you think it will take you to put up the garden shed and then put the bunk beds inside so Hayden and I can come and visit?
Yeah, I'll get back to you on that.
Hang on, if Hayden drives and I get the train, then we can each both sleep in the back of a car.
Well, I was going to say, there's a travel lodge just down the road off the A2. But yeah, so it's lovely. And I've got shiny new internet and... yeah, I'm just starting to settle down, so that's been lovely. And I had my first visitor since living here. Well, he didn't come to the house, but he came from far away over the sea. It was one of our Australian friends of the show, Stephen B, at Steve Starling on Twitter, of the New to Who podcast, which has been on a hiatus for a couple of years, I think. Yeah, so that was great. So he wanted to come and visit Kent. And so he came down to Canterbury, which is just down the road from me. We met up, had a few pints. And then the following day, so I took him to Whitstable, which is the home of Peter Cushing, on the same weekend that the two Peter Cushing movies were being released into cinemas.
Of course.
So I didn't get to see the Peter Cushing movies, but I did get to go and sit on the beach with Stephen and drink beer just outside Peter Cushing's old house, which has a blue plaque on it. And we got to visit Cushing's View, which is a spot where Peter Cushing used to sit and gaze out at the sea, and there's a carved wooden plaque there. So that was nice. And we went into the Wetherspoons that I went in with you, Doc.
That's the Peter Cushing?
Yes, the Peter Cushing, which is a converted bingo hall. It was a cinema, then it was a bingo hall. And it's got lovely art deco decorations and stuff going around. It's a lovely art deco building. And I found out just the other day that Nick, friend of the show, Nick with the headphones on the train.
Oh, yeah.
His grandfather passed away in the toilets of that very building because he'd gone along to the bingo. And so, in a way, he kind of died doing what he enjoyed most.
Oh, no. Shouldn't laugh, really.
Gambling.
Oh, dear.
Nick will be delighted that his grandfather is immortalised on the Diddly Dum podcast, I'm quite sure.
Of course, of course.
But yeah, it was a lovely, lovely weekend. Good to sit and just hang out with another Doctor Who podcaster. Drink beers and yeah. Whitstable was especially nice, I think. That was a really nice, it's a really nice day. So it was lovely just to kind of bathe in Peter Cushing history. Funny enough, you know, I went to Sci-Fi by the Sea, like a little sci-fi convention, in a place called Herne Bay.
I remember you used to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it hasn't been on for a few years, but my sister was in that same town, and she was in the cafe there, and she overheard a customer talking to the lady at the counter, and the customer was saying, oh yeah, I can't wait for the new series of Doctor Who to start. It should be really good. Yeah, yeah. It's really happy that Russell T Davies is back, and that they've got Shooty Gatwa and stuff. Oh, yeah, it should be great. Really excited about it. I'm really into Doctor Who. I listen to a lot of podcasts. And my sister went, oh, do you? She interrupted and said, oh, my brother does a Doctor Who podcast. He said, oh, really? Which one? Yeah. She said, the Diddly Dumb. He went, who? No. He went, he said, no way, Diddly Dumb. That's one of the ones I listen to. And modesty forbids me to report the rest of the conversation. But he was very impressed to meet my sister.
Oh, amazing.
Whose brother was in the Diddly Dumb podcast.
He's probably sitting at home now thinking, now, did she seem more likely to be the sister of Doc, Hayden or Mark?
He did say which one's your brother, and she said Mark. He said, oh, the...
I know, he said, in a disappointed tone of voice.
He said, oh. And she said, Mark, and he said, oh, the funny one.
What?
He did not.
Oh,
he
did. No.
Well, I wasn't going to say that, but I said modesty forbids, but then you kind of gently forced my hand.
I think he's clearly got our names mixed up, don't you, Hayden? The funny one.
I'm going to have to work on my material now, because I thought I was...
you are Hayden.
Yeah, but not in that way.
Oh, maybe that's what he meant.
Oh, God.
A bit funny, isn't he, your brother? Like, odd. So that's another listener. That's like, what, five we've actually met?
Isn't that more than our overall audience? So a couple of them are definitely lying.
Yeah.
Now, if this means that we have indeed finally located our listener, and it was you, listener, drop us an email at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk so we can know who you are. Oh, that's really nice, that.
One of the things as well was, obviously, Steve from New to Who listens to the podcast, and he was...
that makes six!
He's been listening from before I joined. So he's a proper listener. But the annoying thing with that was every time I kept trying to tell him one of my anecdotes, he'd sort of go, oh, is this the one with Bob Geldof? I was like, oh, bugger.
Oh, so he knows them all already.
It's all my best material.
You've exhausted your repertoire, have you, Bob?
Well, exactly. I've given all my best stuff to this podcast. I've got nothing else to give if you actually meet me. I'm just a...
Your best material. And that's saying something, Mark, because as we know, you are the funny one. Anyway, my mate Nick, oh, was he the guy who pulled his headphones jack out on the train?
Yes,
oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, in fact, actually, that did come up because I told him the story of Nick's granddad when we were in the Peter Cushing bar. And he did indeed go... Oh, your friend who had the mishap with the headphones on the train. I was like, yes, that's the one.
Oh,
knows all my punchlines, all my stuff.
To be fair, we repeat them often enough, don't we?
So, well, exactly.
We reference them, I mean, rather than we repeat them.
Yeah, that's the polite way of putting it.
I've not really been doing anything, really. I think it might have been around about the last time we recorded that we were talking about... Oh, I had no idea that because of the anniversary of Bond that they were running all the James Bond films on at the cinemas.
Oh.
I think we just missed. I think the first one I went to see might have been Diamonds Are Forever, so I can't think what we might have just have missed.
On Her Majesty's.
Oh, that's right, yes.
I'm gutted I missed that. That would have been one of the ones I definitely would have wanted to see. I'm not sure I realised it was happening in cinemas near me at the time. Otherwise, I would perhaps have made more of an effort. But unfortunately, I missed Live and Let Die as well, which is another one of my favourites because I grew up with it. I know it's deeply problematic in places and stuff, but I grew up with it. I absolutely love it. But I missed that due to timing and stuff, unfortunately. Then I could get to see Man with the Golden Gun, which I would have liked to have seen a bit of Scaramanga on the big screen. Then, obviously, Spy Who Loved Me would have been great. But in the end, I ended up having to settle for Moonraker.
Oh, I thought you quite liked that, didn't you? Hayden was saying that.
No, well, no, I haven't seen it for years, and I really, really enjoyed it on the big screen. And I think it's quite a good one to see on the big screen, better than some, because it's full of spectacle.
Yes.
And there's, you know, it's a big, joyous, it's fun, you know, and Roger Moore is very much my Bond in the same way that, you know, that kind of Tom Baker kind of is my doctor, because that's who I grew up with. It was same with Roger Moore, because I grew up with his films appearing on the television. Well, I don't think Live and Let Die got shown. I think it's debut. I mean, there was sort of like 6, 7, 8 years between films coming out in cinema and them appearing on television, weren't there, back in the days?
I think it was Live and Let Die that received, was it something like 26 million viewers when it was shown in 82? It was either Live and Let Die or Moonraker, right. which was the highest. And it was Christmas Day viewing, and it was huge. I mean, when you think about it, that sort of, you know, Den Watts giving Angie the divorce papers and the Trotters winning television, you know, the money. It? Yeah, it's that sort of level of viewership.
You know, it's cover of the Radio Times and stuff, and everyone's looking forward to it, and everyone's like, oh, I can't wait to see this film. Because even if you saw it at the cinema, that would have been like 8 years before or something, you know, whatever. And so I remember Live and Let Die coming on. And after that, it seemed to be on every year or two. It was just, I may be wrong about that, but it felt like it. Yeah, so it was one of the films that I grew up with, really. I think for a young lad, so I think Roger Moore's a very likeable, easy Bond
Absolutely.
To kind of get into, isn't it? I think he's got a lot of charm. Whatever you think of the films, there's spectacle. And Roger Moore's in there, and I think his charm and sheer likability and charisma makes up for a lot of the shortcomings of a lot of those later Moore films. But I was a bit gutted I missed Octopussy as well, just because I haven't seen that for years, but I remember it being quite nuts, and I wanted to see him in that alligator submarine.
Yes, yeah.
Because I had the stickers that came with Shredded Wheat, I think.
Oh, my word. Well, I've been a bit burnt out from Bond after doing the podcast. And that finished, 3 years ago now? And I did see No Time to Die, but I just didn't get the same feel for it. And there was a friend of mine who lives in the local area, actually, who I met through James Bond podcast, to those of you who don't know. And he said, do you realise that they're showing weekly in the cinema? I was like, no, I didn't have a clue. And because it's View Cinema, we got Cineworld in the town that I live in, but it's View Cinemas, and the nearest one for that's Cambridge, which is about half an hour away from me. So it's not one of those things I can go to every week. And if it's a film I really, really want to see, and it's that magic of seeing something which, and I was going to get in with our main topic, actually, it's the magic of seeing something that you've grown up watching on a tiny telly on the big screen for the first time and still feeling all the fun, and even though you've watched it several times, well, several hundred times in some cases.
Can I just say, I mean, that was one of the things, seeing that intro to the pre-credits sequence to Moonraker on the big screen, just, I was like, this is incredible. I mean, everyone goes on about this start to Spy Who Loved Me, quite rightly. It's a great start. But man, that's insane, that parachuting malarkey that they have at the start of Moonraker. It's just fabulous, wonderful. Just and on the big screen, it's just like, oh my God. Yeah, in a way that I've never sort of like, you know, it looks pretty cool on your telly, but it's not quite as lacks impact.
I'm taking friend of the show, my mother, to see The Living Daylights on Saturday. So we'll be watching that one. And I'm also going in a couple of weeks' time to see Goldeneye as well. And I'm hoping, fingers crossed, to be going to see Casino Royale, a film I didn't see in the cinema. Because I was broke at the time. I was 17 years old, and my EMA money barely stretched to my weekly allowance of beer at that point. And that's the...
My heart's breaking.
But yeah, it's just something so magical watching them.
I mean, well, you're a huge Bond fan as well.
Sometimes you get places like, you know, Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square will show them occasionally. So, I mean, it's good to keep your eye open for things like that. But there's definitely a market, I think,
So, you know, I've been to films in the past where the Star Wars trilogy, when they re-released, was in 97, I saw A New Hope, Empire and Jedi at the cinema for that. And they were proper, you know, proper event moments. To the point that they had workers at the cinema had dressed up in Darth Vader costumes and were lightsaber fighting before the event, before the film started. And that was pretty cool as well.
I did go and see the Monty Python and the Holy Grail with daughter Polly in the cinema, and that was huge fun going to see that on the big screen with an audience laughing along. It just freshens the film up for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. And considering just how good they look as well now with all the, you know, HD and 4K upscaling, it gives them a new lease of life. I'd love to have seen... It's funnily enough, there's a Heddenham Castle in the village of Sybil Heddenham where I went to secondary school there. They showed the Holy Grail and they projected it onto the side of the castle. And I missed that. But there's definitely some. I'll have to write a list out for some I'd love to see if they're ever shown. I saw the original Frankenstein. It was Frankenstein. Bela Lugosi. Boris Karloff, sorry. The Boris Karloff Frankenstein when I was a student. And that was pretty epic as well. 100 years old. Boris Karloff went to my dad's school. How about that for a name check?
Mm-hmm.
Like 80 years before he did.
I can't remember where I started with Diamonds Are Forever. I might have done. I think I possibly did. And I've seen the whole lot. The only ones I didn't see are Man with the Golden Gun, for which reasons I can't remember. And I missed out on A View to a Kill last week because I was a bit... I had other things to spend my money on. But they've been...
That's a kind way of saying it. You don't think it's very good.
And it's possibly... because I've not seen View to a Kill, that I was able to say, I think, oh, Roger Moore doesn't seem to age as much as I thought he did. It's maybe only in View to a Kill where he really, you know, it's really noticeable that, oh, gosh, you really need to retire, mate. For Your Eyes Only, I enjoyed. I seem to remember that being paralysingly dull.
It's a great film.
On the TV.
Great film.
Fortunately, in my local cinema, it's only ever about five people in to watch the Bond movies, so I've... of course, they always tend to be the noisiest people imaginable. I'm watching a film. Oh, I must check my texts.
You're going to burn in a very special level of hell. A level they reserve for child molesters and people who talk at the theatre.
Yeah, we only had about 10 people in the Moonraker viewing.
Well, The Spy Who Loved Me was full.
Wow!
Yeah, we had a full set for that.
Right, what else has been going on? Eagle Moss. I don't know if you noticed, as they've had to file an intention to file for bankruptcy. I think they're effectively going to fold.
That's very sad.
That's really sad, really. Where the hell am I going to get you two Christmas presents from now on? I don't know. Neil Patrick Harris, had he hoved into view before we finished our last recording?
Hadn't he? I don't know much about him anyway.
Oh, God, no, he hadn't. No, he hadn't. We haven't spoken about that.
Is it generally accepted? I don't think it's been announced that he's actually playing the Celestial Toymaker, is he? But I think it's generally been accepted, hasn't it?
Well, his base, according to... because people, of course, have been on... the Doctor Who set report, people have been on there and loads of people have been retweeting it, and so it's been popping up on my timeline. I've got all the Doctor Who set report hashtags, hashtag DWSR and all that sort of stuff, and Doctor Who spoilers and things like that. I've got them all muted, but people unfortunately don't always put the hashtags on, or they don't put at the start of the thing spoilers, so I've seen quite a lot more than I'd like to, but I know a couple of the pictures were official ones, but I noticed there was one, basically of a toy shop, wasn't there? Sorry, spoilers. I've just done it. Spoilers. One basically of a toy shop, so it's. I imagine everyone who listens to this will have seen the pictures, whether they wanted to or not.
So we're in Bristol, isn't it?
Yes, it was in Bristol, yeah.
Right. Has anyone else got anything to say News-wise?
No. Oh, should we mention, should we mention the Russell T. Davis speech?
I don't know, it might put people off. I don't know if we've not put people off with what we were saying about Liz Truss already.
Well, I didn't say anything much. All I did was make one. I just said something that was just non-committal either way. Just, I do love those pork markets.
Go on then, Hayden. Say something about Russell T. Davis.
No pressure.
I think all I can say is that his acceptance speech almost redeemed the end of time for me. Hey. And I'll leave it there.
Right. Talking of going to see things at the cinema, the recent remastering of the two Peter Cushing Dalek Mania movies was celebrated by their being played in cinemas around the UK. Not last weekend, but the weekend before. And I toddled along to my local Everyman cinema, which is effectively a full-size screen faced by rows and rows of alternating armchairs and sofas with tables on the arms and waitress service. And waiter service, I suppose. And so we thought we would dedicate this episode of the podcast to talking about the two Peter Cushing movies. I understand that I was the only one of the three of us who actually made it to a cinema, is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah, apologies.
Although I was heartened to see that enough people got there to make it, I think it was number 10 in the UK box office last week.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it?
There were three people in my screen.
This is because you're going to really posh cinemas, that's why.
Yeah. That's true.
Man of culture.
I felt I had to go to the cinema because, as those of you who are longer-term listeners to the podcast may remember, in the 1970s, so long ago, it was the time when your parents would just say, oh yeah, you just go down to the cinema if you want. Without anyone's supervision, I and a couple of friends of mine during the summer holidays used to go down to our local cinema in North Manchester. This was in the days, of course, before they'd split these giant cinemas up into multiple, three or four multiplex, smaller screens. Yeah. And they would do this for the school holidays. We would sit in a giant auditorium with a circle or a balcony up top. I don't think I've ever seen a screen that big before. We'd sit right on the front row of the stalls and we would watch. They would put on a full run of Buster Crabbe, Flash Gordon episodes. I don't know how many, four or five or six might have appeared in a series, followed by both of the Dalek movies back to back. And so I would have seen them in the cinema, actually not a great many years after they were actually first released in the cinema. So that was quite a memory for me. So I thought that's why I felt I need to go along to it. Dalek Mania was very much a craze, wasn't it? As we were hitting the mid-60s.
Yeah.
And a film called Amicus took out an option for a film and two possible sequels to make a Dalek film. Doctor Who and the Daleks was produced on a budget of about £180,000 and ended up being in, I think, the top 20 biggest British box office moneymakers in 1965 when it was released.
Didn't Milton Subotsky pay about £500 or something for the film rights?
Yeah, only about that to the BBC and Terry Nation, which I found surprising.
Yes, I don't think Terry Nation let things go away that cheaply afterwards, did he?
Well, I suppose he might have, raked in some more from the actual takings at the cinemas. I don't know, really. Right, so Doctor Who and the Daleks, the first film. Screenplay by David Whittaker. Directed by Gordon Fleming. Filmed in Technicolor. Not just the first Daleks, but the first Doctor Who story. Even if only remotely, that was filmed in colour. Opened in August 1965. Anyone want to start us off?
Yeah.
I remember going to a party once.
Don't worry, this is related. And
car keys stayed in your pocket.
And I picked up the car keys of Roy Castle. And we started. And the father of the host was there. And he was telling me when he said, oh, you know, what kind of things do you write? It was at the time that I was writing Child Out of Time.
Mm.
And I said to him, oh, actually, I'm writing a book about Doctor Who and me growing, you know, during childhood being a Doctor Who fan. And he said, I'll tell you something. He said, when I was a kid, he said, one of those Peter Cushing films came out and it was a really big news. We all crowded around the block to go and see it. And they had these Dalek props that came out of the cinema to sort of go up and down the line of the people who were queuing up outside.
Yeah.
And I said, really? And I mean, this was obviously, I'd heard it was big thing. I'd heard about Dalek Mania and I'd seen the documentary that friend of the show, Kevin Davis, made for the DVD back in the, well, even predated that, wasn't it? I think it was mid-90s he made that. And I thought, blimey, I thought, where was this? Apparently it was up in Middlesbrough. Oh. There was a cinema up in Middlesbrough. And he said that for ages, he said one of his friends was the ticket distributor. She was working in the box office. And she actually took this Dalek prop home. And it was from the film. It did have, you know, the big film. He swore blind that it was. You know, it was. He said, oh, I never really had any time for the TV series. But I loved the films, mainly because of that image. He said he must have been about 5 or 6 years old, waiting in the queue with his older brother. And then this Dalek started saying stuff like, tickets, please. I suppose like the Sons of Skaro, you see.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But my first recollection of watching them, I think it was a Christmas present from my uncle. And I received Doctor Who and the Daleks on VHS. At a time when listeners, younger listeners of the show, so I'm thinking sort of Polly's age and down here.
Anyone under 50.
We still had TVs that were, they were sort of like square.
Oh, yeah, the 4:3.
Yeah, 4:3 dimensions. And sometimes you could buy two variations of VHS. You could buy standard, you could buy a widescreen copy. And I watched Doctor Who and the Daleks a bit like you would if you were watching it through a letterbox.
Yeah, that's right. And do you know what, Hayden? That was the correct way to do it. Because you, that was so well done.
Oh,
you know I'm a stickler for this sort of thing. What you got there was unfortunately, I don't think these scans were always perfectly done. So even the letterbox presentation sometimes would miss off bits. But you saw as much of the print that was filmed as you possibly could, which is exactly what you should do. And it wasn't squashed. Hayden does like to amuse himself occasionally, but he knows a bit sensitive about people watching things stretched or squashed, watching things in the wrong ratio. I can't help it. It makes me... And Hayden loves to send me pictures of himself watching Genesis of the Daleks in glorious widescreen stretched right across the screen. Oh, it drives you nuts.
Now I know that it triggers you.
Yeah, it really does.
I think we're going to have to do a Christmas game on this podcast, where it's guess the story, it's incredibly zoomed.
Stretched vertically.
It was years, wasn't it, Hayden, before you realised that Davros had that sort of third eye in the middle of his forehead?
Didn't know he was in a motorised chair, and until he starts talking about the life support on his chair, you know. Oh, I just thought he was really short. So thank you, Mark, for that TED talk on aspect ratios. That was really enlightening. And I really liked it, because it seemed to be, for me, it kind of, apart from that crazy beginning, it seemed to be in line with the Target book. It was so close to the Target novelization. Apart from, obviously, well, both of them have very crazy beginnings, don't they? But as soon as they're on Skaro, it felt very note for note.
Mind you, that was written by David Whittaker as well, wasn't it?
It was. Yes, it was, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And I found it endearing as the Doctor. Of course, it used to do my head in. That I couldn't place him in the canon. A bit like Joe Martin now. It's kind of like, where did he fit? But I love the way that he's very... The humanising of the Doctor in these films, I also find quite endearing. You know, that moment where... It's a very good visual joke to start the film off, where Susan's reading a book about... is astrophysics.
Physics for the Inquiring Mind.
Books for the Inquiring Mind, that's it. And then it's Barbara's reading The Science of Science, and then the Doctor's reading, or sorry, Doctor Who, I should say, is reading The Eagle. Oh, most exciting.
That's very funny, yeah. Physics for the Inquiring Mind by Eric M. Rogers was an actual, quite a famous physics textbook at the time. It wasn't just something they'd made up. It's interesting, isn't it? I think in the 70s, when there was effectively, if there was a Doctor Who, I think it's probably even predated things like the Dwas, if there was a Doctor Who fandom at all, it might be, say, something you wrote off for and sent a postal order to get a membership badge of something or something. You would never actually know why. It didn't seem to faze me at all that there was a Doctor that I knew wasn't William Hartnell and I knew wasn't the Doctor who'd originally appeared on the TV. But it didn't seem to confuse me at all. I do understand that, you know, you were saying that you felt a bit like with Joe Martin.
Yeah.
I hear that similarly, the citizens of Whitstable complained that the very first Whitstable Doctor should be appearing something that wasn't actually canon. And they found that quite offensive. But he's very much not our Doctor, though, is he?
No.
He's seeing the lines and he's meeting the monsters and doing the things in the plot that the first Doctor did. And in a way, he's almost wearing the clothes.
Yeah.
If you excuse the difference between colour and black and white. But I can't remember if we were outraged at the time that when he first said, "Hello, my name is Doctor Who." I think we were so young that we weren't old enough to actually be offended by that sort of stuff.
I think some of his mannerisms are slightly Hartnellish. I think there's sort of an element there, and stuff, that kind of thing. But he's obviously a much softer-edged, warmer person. As you said, it's because he's human. He doesn't have to do any alien stuff. Mm. He doesn't have to be this, you know, he's not from another planet or the Hartnell was necessarily from another planet, as far as we knew at first. But he was from another time, and he was a crotchety old, you know, whereas there's none of that.
You'd never get Bill calling Susan Susie, would you?
No.
He said, "What are you doing, child?"
But all the actors, the actresses, they all loved him, didn't they? Because he was such a charming, lovely man. And I think he stayed in touch with all of them for a long time. He used to write to Roberta Tovey. And used
really? Oh, that's lovely.
He used to call her granddaughter. To my granddaughter, Roberta. Yeah, and he was friends with Jenny Linden for ages as well. Her and her husband used to go and stay with Peter and his wife in Whitstable during the summer and stuff. And
I love that sort of thing.
And they said he was just wonderful to be around. And he used to potter around the house in his Edwardian clothes and stuff. Because that's what he liked wearing. And so when he did all the old hammers and things like that, he'd always take those beautiful Edwardian or Victorian suits and things that they used to dress him in. And he had some wonderful, sharp, gorgeous costumes in his hammer stuff. And he would keep them and take them home. So he'd have wardrobes full of all his marvellous suits and stuff.
You think of him, don't you, even in Hammer films, if he's that one that he was in, I think, with Roy Castle.
Dr. Terror's House of Horror.
You're thinking he's usually the shopkeeper of something like the old curiosity shop that you can imagine has been there since Victorian times.
Mm.
That sort of thing. But I love that sort of thing because I don't listen to the commentaries on Tom Lallister DVDs. It quite upsets me that they quite clearly don't get on nowadays. Mm. I mean, I'm not saying that I've got a right to expect them to, but it quite upsets me, that sort of thing. I try to stay away from Peter's here as well. I don't like the fact that clearly some of them don't get on with Matthew. But it's also, I think, I was only joking earlier when I said that about we weren't old enough to start being offended by that sort of thing. Because I think at that age, we must have been maybe 9, 10 or 11. Me and my friends, and it just didn't occur to us to think, oh, it's a different Doctor, and he's not quite like the way the Doctor's played. And Susan isn't a little schoolgirl, she's a young woman. Didn't bother us at all. And maybe we ought to leave Doctor Who podcasting up to kids rather than ourselves. Except that by now, what is it? It's 9:05 now. In the evening, we'd have been all sent to bed, wouldn't we? So we wouldn't be able to do any recording. and so I think it's only now that I think, oh, he's quite the, you know, nice, avuncular, he's human, right? I don't think I even cared about him being called Doctor Who. It's just strange, isn't it?
I think because we've grown up with it, and so it's always we have these two Peter Cushing movies, but they're different from the serial. And we've just grown up with that and gone, well, that's fine. That's it's just immediately accepted. That's what we got. And the other thing is, these films are, I mean, they may not be to everyone's taste, but I don't think you could describe these films as bad in any way, really. These are good films. These are good, solid matinee entertainment that easily stands with that type of thing of the time, if not better than a lot of stuff that was being done at that time.
It quite reminds me, this one, this Doctor and the Daleks one, of what was the film that had Robbie the Robot in?
Forbidden Planet.
And Leslie Nielsen. I'm not saying that the plot or the characters or anything, but the sort of...
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Almost the colour palette.
The colour palette. I want to get onto that. Can I just say, but the thing is, these films were good, and I think if Doctor Who had been calling himself, hello, my name is Doctor Who, I'm a human, look at my terrible TARDIS interior, and the rest of the film was really poor as well, we would absolutely... But because the rest of the film's so enjoyable, we just go, it's fine.
Can I just say about the interior? The moment that Ian opens the door, there's this electronic sound that's playing in the background, and it immediately sent a shiver down my spine because it is exactly the same electronic sound that you can hear in the very first episode of Captain Scarlet when...
I thought you were going to say when you tried to Skype me and Mark.
When the Mysteron base is being reconstructed after Captain Black has opened fire on it.
Oh, right.
It's the same, because it's Barry Gray who does the electronic music for Doctor Who and the Daleks, and obviously he was the man behind...
This is excellent nerdery, Hayden.
Yeah, because he's obviously the man who was behind, well, everything Gerry Anderson related from... I think it was from Supercar... through to Space 1999, I think. So that sound gets replayed again. So when Ian opens the door, I hear the, Earthmen, we are peaceful beings, and you have come to destroy us. And the whole thing from,
What do we think of the interior?
Crap.
It's super disappointing. It's my biggest problem with both the films. I think it's a bit tidier on the second one, and I'm not sure if that's a good thing or bad thing, because it looks quite sparse in the second film. I don't think we get to see quite so much of the interior, do we?
It's very sort of H.G. Wells time machine, isn't it? Rather than Doctor Who futuristic.
Mm. You can't beat the classic console, can you, really?
And if you think about it, I mean, even though I agree with you, these aren't bad films at all.
No.
But the things in the contemporaneous whatever TV series at the time that we think of as being better, i.e., the character of the Doctor, the character of Susan as this unearthly child, the amazing interior design of the TARDIS, it makes you think, wow, those really are extraordinary achievements for the original TV show. Although I must say, I do think that it wasn't until 2005 that we saw better Daleks than this.
Yeah, I agree. There's something more intimidating about these ones.
The height.
exactly, but everything seems to be in a bigger dimension. The skirting board seems higher. Like I said, the height of them is higher. The ears are higher, aren't they?
You mean the lights?
Yeah.
But the ears, honestly.
Their voices seem to resonate more as well.
It must be the difference between a cinematic set and Lime Grove Studio D.
They look magnificent, don't they? They're just those shots where there's multiple Daleks rolling round, and it's just joyous. And that's one thing they could do that you can't get on the TV series. You can get, I think it was 18 Daleks or something I counted in one shot in the first film. And they just look magnificent. How did they look on the big screen?
Actually, I couldn't actually tell whether they were showing us this, was it 4K remastered version or not.
Right.
It looked brilliant, but then the last time I seen it on a big screen, I remember it looking, oh, wow, isn't that amazing anyway? But sort of childlike delight. So, oh, that's amazing. And I couldn't help thinking what I always thought, whether it's on TV or big screen. They've clearly put money into this, haven't they? Maybe not into the costumes of the Thals, but into things like the jungle, the city.
Oh, the petrified forest. Oh.
Yeah, it's glorious.
That, I mean, they didn't need to do, for any reason at all, to do the plot, did they? Had the you know, the slope leading up to the city parts in the middle.
Yeah.
But it's just, oh, let's just do that because it looks great. The water pipes going over the mountain. And then the big hall of the Daleks with the control panels provided by Tom Bowler. I think that's glorious.
Oh, and the lava lamps.
You know, the big sort of hexagonal
control
panel on the right-hand wall that's...
Oh, yes.
That's supposed to be going up and down.
Oh, on one of the television screens on there, my dad used to swear blind that you could see William Hartnell's title sequence. Out of all the blibs and blobs on the screen. And I watched it yesterday. No, it's definitely not there. I reckon it must have been his mind playing tricks on him. But
well, that's another thing. On the far wall of that big hall where they've got all the little TV screens.
Hmm.
And that actually comes down to the ground.
Yeah, it's an amazing set.
To reveal a little hiding place for the Daleks. That's another thing that's... Wow, it's amazing. There's a point at which, just before the Thals, or you know, just as the countdown... He's getting towards 20 or something at the end. Mm. And just for the Thals all rush in, they pull back to they see this full scene of this big hall, and all the Daleks, for some reason, all move towards the big Tombola control panel. And it looks extraordinary. It looks amazing. I think Shawcraft made 8 new props. And then on top of that, they had, I'm not sure if they were plaster, but they were just dummies that couldn't actually fit anyone in. I think they were mostly at the back of that thing where, you know, the Black Dalek is saying, destroy the Thals.
Mm.
And then they're all in this meeting room repeating it.
Mm. But that petrified forest, the colours are just amazing, aren't they? Mm. The lighting. The lighting and the filters used, or whatever. I don't know if they have, like, coloured lenses or you know, coloured bits over the cameras. But I'm not sure there is, because the colours are in such contrast, aren't they?
Yes.
Like you'll get someone in the foreground quite close to the camera and a nearby tree sort of in bright blue, and then behind them there'll be like this really bright magenta sort of mountains and stuff. And it reminded me weirdly of David Tennant era Doctor Who, but it gets away with it a lot better because it's a proper alien planet and it's like, why shouldn't they? Whereas David Tennant's constantly going into cellars and things like, and factories on Earth. And they've all got magenta lighting and cyan lighting and stuff. It's very teal. It's very weird. It looks amazing, those colours. It's a beautiful looking film for most of the time.
It is. Even the forced perspective work, which is when they put like a matte painting.
Yeah, like the mountain.
Yeah, nearer the camera and put everything else further away.
Mm.
They did it on stuff like Hitchhiker's Number as well. But it was, you know, it's glorious. That there were a few things I noticed this time that
the Thal who goes with Ian and Barbara
and the Mitchell brothers on the expedition over the mountain is such a red shirt. The only involvement he has is, I'll go fill up these water bottles.
Oh yes, yeah.
It reminded me a bit of, funny enough, we mentioned it earlier, the Holy Grail, Sir Bors. Who just appears out of nowhere and goes to meet the killer rabbit and gets decapitated straight
away. Yes.
He was there just to be disposable. I have to admit that this time round, I don't know whether it's because I've watched these fairly infrequently, actually. I do have them on Blu-ray. Well, I think one of them's out, sold out now. I think it's the Dalek Invasion of Earth one, sadly. But
really?
Yeah.
It's not fair. They shouldn't be able to...
Yeah.
I should keep them for... special people like us, like when we eventually get around to paying for them.
Well, exactly. But
this time around, I did watch it and think those Thals, God, they're gorgeous.
Well, you know, that's fairly heavy eye makeup. That does something for me. You know, just something for everyone.
I know Jenny Linden was on the commentary, was very taken with the Thals. And when they would had a late shoot on or an early shoot the next morning, apparently they'd stay over in a hotel. She spent many nights apparently drinking with them in the bar. She said they were absolutely gorgeous. She said there was a couple of nights as well where she didn't actually go to bed at all, but got into trouble from Gordon Fleming. Yeah, so she, Jenny Linden apparently was half cut for much of the filming. Apparently she had terrible hangovers quite often.
Do you reckon that might explain why, out of all of the goo that's on that food tray, she goes for the coloured one instead of it's a bit like if you have like the Neapolitan ice cream. I know, I'll scoop out the brown one, you know, the chocolate is. She has a lime one there, she has strawberry. No, all I'm saying is if I was stuck on that, in that petrified forest, then I wouldn't mind being surrounded by these Aryan sex gods. That's all I'm saying.
I've always assumed that's why you were so keen to join the Diddly Dumb podcast, Aiden. I don't know if red hair counts as Aryan. The problem with Daleks, as far as I see, though, although the sound of the voice is great, do you know when they redid the Dalek voices on Day of the Daleks when they released the special DVD?
Yeah,
I do think the length of time they take to say a sentence,
yes,
is painful, isn't it?
Yeah, especially when you've just got essentially the shot is one Dalek facing another Dalek. They're not moving, and the scene just does drag on. That's definitely one of the weaknesses. Yeah.
I can't work out why it is. I always wondered whether is it because they're trying to time the voice to the flashing lights on the dome and they can't make them flash any quicker than that, or...
I think it's just the way that Daleks speak on television, and so it's one of the things they've copied and they shouldn't have. So,
you got this strange thing, haven't they, where the Dalek says, we want one of you to go out and get these drugs from the jungle.
We want one of you to go out and buy drugs.
Oh, yeah.
It's a bit no complications, isn't it?
No complications.
To be fair, it seems to be fixed by the time they release the second film.
Mm. Yes, it does.
One of you four must go outside the city. Which will it be?
There's quite a lot of weird things with the Dalek voices. One of the things they always seem to get, invariably seem to get right with the Daleks, apart from little things like, is it in the chase, is it one of the Daleks say, something like that, is they get, they don't have like colloquial speech patterns. They don't say, like when in at the end of Bad Wolf, when the Daleks are telling the Doctor, oh, we've got Rose, you know. They don't say, we've got your friend.
Yeah.
They say things like, we have your associate.
Oh, really? Why is that?
We have your associate.
I quite like things like that, but when in here, sometimes they go to completely the opposite end of the spectrum. And when they're escaping in the lift, the Dalek is running after them shouting, come down at once, which sounds like... sounds like a mum shouting up at a little child scrambling upstairs, doesn't it?
Stay where you are. Come down at once.
And there's that bizarre thing that Susan says when they land on the planet.
Coward, I for one am going to investigate.
I for one. But apart from that, that's really scraping the barrel for things to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Got Roberta Tovey you just mentioned. I think she's really good in both of these films. I think she's a cracking little actor.
She's far better than I remember. So I think I possibly long thought of her as the sort of the Adric of the technical era. As in, oh, she's a little kid, isn't she annoying? But if you think about it, both Jill Curzon and Jenny Linden hardly get a look in, do they?
No.
If you think about it, the Doctor, I mean, particularly in the second film, Peter Cushing's ill at some stage, isn't he? So they've had to rewrite some scenes that he was in.
Is that definitely true, though?
Yeah, not sure what was wrong with him.
Which ones? Which scenes?
Well, you know the whole thing where Susan and what's the Scots guy called, Wyler, go barreling down the street in that little blue van and smash through the crowd of Daleks. I think that was to replace stuff that the Doctor was meant to be in.
No, but that's what Barbara does in the TV series, so surely it's just having different characters do that.
I love that scene. I know we're skipping forward a film, but oh, that's...
Well, it doesn't matter. It's fine. We can skip around, can't we?
Even the Doctor, I think, possibly because he's so avuncular, I don't notice him as much. He doesn't have that much to do. I think in both films, you're mainly focused on Susan and Ian, or Susan and Tom. And in many spaces, actually, in the second film, it's Susan and Wyler, isn't it?
Mm, yeah.
Scott's like, who are the ones who were... I mean, Tom is mainly messing around with the Robomen's cafeteria. And she really is good. Yeah, you get that thing like, oh, I, for one, I'm going to do this, grandfather. But I think she's great.
Yeah, she really is.
Even in the second film, where she says... she might not be as fabulously and unearthly weird as Carol Ann Ford was as Susan. She's certainly braver. In that second film, she says, oh, I think I've hurt my... She just glances down at her foot and says, oh, I think I've hurt my ankle, grandfather. Yeah. Versus, oh, grandfather, my ankle! My ankle! She didn't annoy me at all. And I wonder if sometimes I've been retrospectively annoyed by, you know, One take Toby. Oh dear.
Gosh, hello.
What an amazing striker she was.
Beautiful left foot.
One touch Toby.
That one take Toby story can sound a bit pretentious, but actually, if you think about it, it just shows that she was doing it quite well.
Hmm.
And I think it went really well. What do we think of Roy Castle?
He isn't as good as One Touch Toby or her strike partner Pele. Do you know what? Some people say that they really don't like Roy Castle's portrayal of Ian, but I do, because it's a different take. Mm. And it works, yeah. And it's consistent throughout the film.
Yeah.
There's bits when... I'm going to harp back to it again, but the bits when they're climbing over the mountain... And the bit when they're jumping over the ravine and all the rest of it. He does them. He shows that there is bravery there, but he's hesitant to do them, which is a very... And Barbara shoots him a look. Come on, Ian. Don't you jump over mountains or over, like, perilous 1,000-foot drops every week? Oh, please, you know. As if it's like a high wire at a scout day out. And I always think she's a bit of a bully for that, really. I think, when you get home, Ian... You tell Barbara it's over. You deserve much, but you know, you deserve much better than that. There might be a dodo out there for him. I don't know, or a Sarah Kingdom in this extended universe. You know, this multiverse of who? I don't know, but it's I like it. But for me, I think his performance and his portrayal is blown out of the water by Bernard Cribbins in Dalek Invasion of Earth, because I think he hits every single note. He is...
It's quite deliberately slapsticky with Roy Castle, isn't it? It's clearly written to be like that.
It's very physical. It's like big physical, whereas with Bernard Cribbins, there's much smaller stuff that's funny. Roy Castle does big, cheesy things, which he's incredibly good at, and which he's very talented at, and it is a talent. Mm. And he's a very multi-skilled, multi-talented performer.
Yes.
And he's great. He does what he's supposed to do, which is he lightens the film up for children, because you've got these big, scary Daleks. You know, you've got people being killed. You've got danger all around. And so you clearly, it's a movie at the end of the day. People are supposed to go to cinema to see it. Yeah. So people are supposed to take their children. So they've got this guy who's, it's going to be child-friendly. And it is, and it's fine. It does what it needs to do. But I agree with Hayden. I think Bernard Cribbins' performance is funnier with smaller performance.
I think Bernard Cribbins is far more an actor, whereas Roy Castle's career was far more as a performer, wasn't it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I was only watching something earlier today when he was on Parkinson's show with Buddy Rich, and they were tap dancing together, and Sammy Davis Jr. walks onto the stage out of the blue. But he's really good. He comes across as slightly awkward and self-conscious at times. But I'm not sure if people outside the UK, even outside mine and Mark's generation, will be that familiar with it. But he was an enormous figure in children's television at the time. I think we mainly knew him through Record Breakers, which was on for about 20 years.
But he did have a big career in the 60s before that, didn't he? Like with music, dancing, well, everything. He's a proper, what's the word?
Entertainer, yeah.
All-rounder, isn't he?
And he's proper all-round entertainer, you know, proper like cabaret and, oh, revue performer. You know, he can do everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think he still holds his world record. I think he's still unbeaten for tap dancing speed. I think he reached 24 taps per second.
Oh, my Jesus. Word.
That was done in 1973, and I can remember. So I was watching the YouTube on YouTube the other day. I thought, I actually remember watching that. I can remember the little machine that they used to work out the speed he was doing. I think he had the world record for playing the same tune on 43 different instruments within 4 minutes. Stuff like that.
Wow.
He was a sort of almost like a less famous version of Bruce Forsyth.
Yeah.
How are you going to say you knew him, Hayden?
It's rather sad, actually, for me, because when I was growing up, he was in Record Breakers, but he was very ill in Record Breakers. I remember him being very, very gaunt and very bald-headed in it.
Yeah.
And I actually remember the one when just after he'd passed away as well. And I remember that being quite sad. And seemed to be something that affected my parents as well, which was, as in, you know, it's obviously a big, big personality from their childhood. So I knew him from that, but I also knew him as Captain Keen from Up the Khyber, which I know everyone says Carry On Cleo is the best.
He's good in that.
I actually think Carry On Up the Khyber because it's still hilarious, and he is very good in it. Yeah, he is very good as Captain Keen.
Yeah.
And I also knew, funnily enough, obviously through the Dalek film as well, but I used to be in the Air Training Corps in my early teens, and my next door neighbour was the warrant officer for 2523 Squadron, Linton, which is what I was a part of. And I don't know why, but we were talking once, Roy Castle came up in the conversation, and it transpired my warrant officer's father was in the same jazz club as Roy Castle, and he used to, obviously Roy Castle was really good at playing the trumpet, and I think he was the pianist. So he knew Roy Castle, yeah. Which was interesting, and he said he was a really nice guy. But Peter Cushing, they both died of cancer around the same time, didn't they? I was trying to look this up. I think it was within a month of each other, they both passed away.
Gosh, what a come down! Dropping from the Air Force to podcasting. When Hayden interviewed friend of the show Kevin Davis on our podcast 40, and he was talking about putting together the. Was it more than 30 years in the TARDIS?
Yes, it was, yeah.
A tape or DVD. And he'd got together Jenny Linden and Roberta Tovey to do some... It might have been a bit of film, it might have just been photographs. And someone mentioned to Kevin, oh, purely by coincidence, Roy Castle's filming something in the next door studio.
Previously on Diddly-Dum.
I was very pro the films. Now, some fans are very, especially in those days, are very sniffy about the films. There's some people nowadays who just dismiss them as a bit of merchandising tat that happened to happen. You know, that nothing, it's not canon, so it doesn't really matter. I know it's not canonical, but it's just, it's lovely. I love that era, and it's real 60s, you know, hokum sort of thing. It's beautiful design work as well. And I like the atmosphere and I like the music. Why I went on to do Dalek Mania once I got the opportunity a couple of years after 30 years. But I felt it was important to include them because I wanted to tell the Dalek story. I'd already prepped the Terry Nation documentary, so I'd done a bit of work on it. And I knew that I couldn't leave them out. If we were going to tell the story of Doctor Who, at the time, their one and only cinema outing had to be mentioned. And I thought it was a great opportunity to try and find some of the cast. I don't know if you know this, but Roy Castle visited us in studio when we were doing 30 years. On the day that we had Jenny Linden and Roberta Tovey in, we found out that Roy Castle, by sheer fluke, was doing a Record Breakers Christmas special, I think, in the studio next door, same day. And we tried to get a message through to him, but of course we'd heard all this stuff about, you know, he'd been through the cancer thing, he'd been in remission, and then we'd heard that he'd got it again. And it had all been very, very sensitive. And so I think his production team were being very protective of him, quite rightly. And the message wasn't getting through. And in the end, I think a friend of Mike Tucker's was a floor assistant on the Record Breakers program. So we got the word through to him unofficially.
Yeah.
Through It's Who You Know, you know.
Oh.
And lo and behold, he turned up during one of the tea breaks. And we got photographs. So there are photographs of him on the Dalek set with Jenny Linden and Roberta Tovey. The cameraman said to me at that point, do you want us to film this?
Yeah.
I've got to talk about him in a minute. The cameraman, John Adderley, was brilliant. But do you want us to film this? And I felt really torn. I thought, God, yes, I want this on film. But the crew really needed their break. So I said, no, it's all right, John. Just go and take the boys off. Go and have your tea break. I thought, this one's for the fans. This is something, because we hadn't got a deal with him. We hadn't made an arrangement with Roy Castle to film him. He very kindly posed for some photographs. It was very sweet because they hadn't met each other in all those years. So I remember shaking his hand and thanking him profusely for coming in. He said, oh, I wouldn't have missed it. You know, he was very, very nice. And I'm so glad that we had that moment with him. I kick myself. If it was like nowadays, we'd have all been filming it on our phones.
It sounds like, of course you would, you know, something pop my tail and take 20 minutes. Who's going to say, oh no, I'm not interested? But actually, I think you can imagine lots of people who probably wouldn't say, oh, I don't remember them. And I think that's the sort of person he probably was, an old professional. Something else I've discovered when I was reading up on this is that I think we're all familiar with product tie-ins, more with Dalek Invasion Earth. But when they were publicising Doctor Who and the Daleks, issue 28 of TV Century 21 comic was almost wholly handed over to plug the film. And there was a Spot the Difference competition to win one of three of the film's prop Daleks, full-size. I think there were two photos of the big control panel in the Daleks' main hall. And you say there are seven errors, you have to circle them. And then you complete the sentence. If I met a Dalek in the street, I would... dot, dot, dot. And on page 13 of this issue of TV Century 21, we have Lady Penelope investigates the stars of the sensational new film, Doctor Who and the Daleks. Come along, I can't do it, Lady Penelope voice. Come along, Parker, I announced. Put on your best bib and tucker. We're going to have lunch with the Daleks. The Daleks, he replied in alarm. Well, if it's all the same to you, milady, I'd just as soon stay at home. Oh, don't be silly, Parker. I don't actually mean the Daleks, just the actors who are in the new film. Oh, that's different, milady. What are we waiting for? Previous investigations had revealed some interesting facts about the actors we were going to meet. You all know Roy Castle. That versatile and very talented young man who has been called Britain's Sammy Davis Jr. And he goes on and on and on.
It was like they were in the room, Mark, wasn't it? If he'd have heard you doing that, then my son got very excited because he is Thunderbirds mad at the moment.
We arrived at our rendezvous in Soho, a delightful little Italian restaurant. Roy Castle, an absolutely charming and modest young man with a quiet sense of humour, and his co-star Jenny Linden, blonde and very pretty, wearing a most becoming fluffy hat and dashing outfit with her. Parker was quite taken and put on his very poshest accent, the old snob. And then I think that leads into the thing about the competition. Would we say that we can say this compared to the equivalent story of the Bill Hartnell incarnation? Do you think one's better than the other? Or do we think they're just not comparable?
Yeah, I think this is better.
I think in both cases they're better. Because they cut the fluff. And you're not actually losing anything. I mean, I counted it. The first film is 1 hour, 22 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The length you would get of three and a bit episodes of The Daleks.
That's true.
And
yeah.
The second film is 1.5 hours. And I could not think of anything that they lost out of it.
I mean, you don't get...
The slither.
You don't get the end of the episode with Barbara retreating from the Daleks the first time, do you?
Well, okay. Yeah.
No, but that's a bad thing, I think. Because that's a plus thing about the Hartnell era, I think.
Oh, okay.
Well, I would. Well, so did we all.
But I wonder, because I saw these films before I saw The Daleks and The Dalek Invasion of Earth. I mean, like I said, I had the Target book for both of them. And like I said earlier, you know, apart from the crazy first scene and the first chapter in the book for the first one, there's not really too much that's between either of them. And it's just so... It's like looking at a suit on a peg and then having it tailored to your exact measurement. And it just feels right. And that's kind of how these films feel for me, runtime-wise, and what they've done with the actual story. I don't think too much is lost. Okay, yeah, the slither is. Yeah, okay, I'll admit that one. But apart from that, I actually think the beats are still there, aren't they? There's not too much.
Yeah, but what I think is they're different things created to do different things. So I put that really badly. They're different mediums, aren't they?
Yes.
So
yeah.
And they're designed to do different things. Yeah. So it's fair what you say, but the Dalek TV serial was never intended to be sat down and watched like all those episodes, all one after the other. It was made to fill TV time and to be entertaining for a duration of 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fair. That's fair.
Whereas, you know, it was, 82 minutes is the film, which is a good length film, especially for kids. It's very much like comparing apples and oranges, because obviously, you know, the Dalek props have had more money put into them. The sets look so much better. If you look at the budget and what they managed to do with the budgets that they had in the BBC, they've done pretty well, really. And you do miss that Dalek cliffhanger threatening Barbara.
Okay.
Because you don't get that. You just get Jill Curzon running into a dead end and then screaming. And they don't have to suck it.
I really like the TV stories as well. I don't want that to be lost on anyone. I really like them. I just think I would watch these over those because I really like these films. And I have to say, the Dalek Invasion of Earth 2050 AD is such a good... It builds upon the first film. It's a brilliant sequel, I think. And I love how vicious the Daleks are in it.
Mm.
You know, you've got that moment when the guy does the assault course when he's trying to escape them and decides, oh, running up the...
The stunt guy who actually broke his...
Broke his leg, yeah, when he falls down. Yeah, that bit. And when Philip Maddock gets blown up in the shed as well, it's such a good scene. That the moment of realisation, he thinks, oh, hang on.
Yeah.
The silence from the Daleks, and he runs in for cover, and they just completely annihilate it.
Just while you've mentioned Philip Maddock, just shout out to Philip Maddock, as ever. He's just the coolest man on screen, isn't he? He's still that in that big trench coat. He's just effortlessly cool, even though he's the bad guy. It's just like, oh man, he's such a bastard in it as well.
He is, great. The moment when he kicks the beans over on the stove.
I think it's coffee, isn't it? I don't know what it is, because I think he was sipping. He might have been sipping beans from the can. The monster.
Spoon. So the first film was quite a success, which led to them taking up their option to do a second film. Dalek's Invasion Earth 2150 AD, which is... their version of the actual Bill Hartnell story, the Dalek Invasion of Earth, opened in cinemas in July 1966, had an increased budget from 180,000, the budget went up to 286,000. And I was trying to think, which do I like better of the two? And I don't think I can, because I don't think they're comparable. This is very much an action film, isn't it? We're saying things like the stuntman falling off the side of the building and breaking his ankle. The most really you get from that is Ganatus falling down off the cliff when they're trying to jump over it. And even then, you start to think, God, I do wish he'd die because he's so annoying.
Mm.
Whereas that's very much more, you've got the Daleks in the city and you've got the Thals outside, haven't you? There's no sense that the Daleks are actually actively oppressing the Thals, except in the fact that they want to kill them all. Yeah, it's two very separate worlds, isn't it?
Yes.
And I think this is a more exciting film, but I suspect that the first film is a more visually attractive film. What do you think of Dalek's Invasion of Earth, Mark?
Oh, I think it's an absolutely cracking film. But I'm a bit like you with regards to choosing which one's better. I think in a way, it's a little bit like trying to choose between Alien and Aliens.
Yes.
Again, like I said about the TV series and the films, this is two films trying to do different things, really.
But it's a bit like trying to choose between, say, Genesis and Blink, isn't it? They're two entirely different types of stories.
Yeah.
Next week, listeners, we compare Genesis of the Daleks and Blink.
I mean, the action's picked up. Like I say, Bernard Cribbins is a very different lead.
Mm.
You know, he ends up in that Robo-Man outfit.
Yes.
When I was a kid, I used to think the Robo-Men looked really cool.
So did I.
I used to think, wow, that uniform they're wearing with that motorbike helmet and those shades and those guns, I'd like to get dressed up like that. Nobody would mess with me then. I'd be all manly. I'd look dead cool and dead hard in that. And then and I was watching it today. I was thinking, Christ, there's campers, anything else, mate. It couldn't be anything. When I was a kid, I thought that all that black PVC and motorbike helmet was all very butch. And as I've got older, I've sort of gone, oh, hold on a minute.
It's fetish world, isn't it, really? I did think when they, when I eventually saw the William Hartnell version, must have been on UK Gold in the 90s, I think, and you saw the original Robo-Men, and they're just sort of shambling around. It just looked like a dressed down Friday at work, really, in my office.
I know. Yeah, they are quite disappointing. I see why Chris Achilleos went for the movie Robo-Man on the front cover of Dalek Invasion of Earth.
I do think it's quite hilarious when they find the dead Robo-Man in the warehouse right at the beginning. And they open up the radio thing on his helmet and the doctor says, highly advanced.
Yeah, I got that in my notes. Highly advanced.
It's got a little 5-amp fuse inside it.
But, I mean, the design, this is great. That Dalek saucer is beautiful.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
It really is a marvellous thing. And they use that matte painting as well, again, don't they? Well, they've got that big matte painting of the spaceship, but then they've got a real ramp that seems to go up into it.
I only realised that last night, I think, on a YouTube video I was watching. I had no idea they'd done that. I assumed they'd actually built.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'd really noticed it before. I thought they built a massive ship as well. Oh, another thing I've noticed in Dalek Invasion of Earth that I've never noticed before was a Louis Marks Dalek blowing up towards the end. That's one of the toys.
What, in the mine?
When the bomb goes off and there's just a shot of a Louis Marks Dalek painted. Well, it looks like it's painted silver and black.
I think I must have missed that.
But the shape of it was unmistakable. It's only on screen very quickly. For some reason, I've never noticed it before. Also, I like the fact that in Dalek Invasion of Earth, one of the workers in the mine, the one who ends up in the shed, who knows Maddox's character, he sounds like he's doing a John Coleshaw impersonation.
An impersonation of an impersonator?
Yeah, he does though. His voice, to me, sounded like John Coleshaw's normal voice.
Have you just escaped out of that spaceship that just landed?
We were just rhapsodising about the spaceship model.
My God, I love that. No, oh, I love that saucer. That is a proper, proper flying saucer, that. With different flying sections as well going round it. Oh, yeah, it's a brilliant model, that.
Rotate, yeah. Yeah, they've not messed around with it, have they? They've just gone bang.
So much so that they used it again in, what was it, the Body Stealers in 1969?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Mask and I were just talking about when the saucer has landed in the middle of London and there's all that focus on the ramp. That, well, I had no idea at the top half it was just a matte painting.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know,
they effectively did the ramp and the metal legs. That's extraordinary. I'd not known that. First time I knew that in my whole life the other day. But I do think the other thing about this, I think it goes for both films, is they've not really spared much money on investing in the sets, have they? They go quite over the top with the ruins of London. I know, I think the street where they drive down in the van and smash into the Daleks is effectively a back lot at Shepperton that's already there. But a lot of it is amazing. I think there's also a matte painting at the very end at the mine, isn't there? Where obviously there isn't a spaceship on the hill behind. And the set of just the mine headquarters with the hole in the middle. I think they really go over the top with it, and it's extraordinary.
Mm.
What we were saying about it's much more of an action adventure film, this. I was talking about the stuntman breaking his leg. But Tom opening the door and falling out of the house with it.
Yeah.
So he's just, oh, my stuntman word. Is just hanging from the doorknob.
And then the door flies off. The door falls off, doesn't it? Just as he's managed to get back in the... Really good. I don't know whether that door was supposed to fall off or not. It really sort of... It adds to the... It adds to the air of absolute decay, doesn't it?
Mm,
yeah.
In the city. It's really evocative of... Because obviously everyone's dressed as like 1950s, 1960s everyday people would have dressed, aren't they? They're all in very, you know... typical attire. And it did make me think, I was like, this is, what, 66 that came out? And obviously the television version came out in 1964, both of which were only just 20 years after the Blitz.
Mm.
So you'd have had people watching this film and obviously its TV counterpart who would have remembered London looking fairly similar to that. Very on the nose.
Because let's face it, that's not London of the 2150, is it? That's London of, like you say, the late 50s.
Yes.
Could even be in places during the Blitz.
Yeah.
Some of it's so old looking. Which I suppose is a slight criticism.
Hmm.
But it does look fantastic. I wonder if the film would have done better if they'd set it in a ruined New York or something. I mean, for the American audience, I mean.
Yeah.
Because it didn't do so well in America, especially the second film.
Mm. See, it worked for me because I thought, well, with everything being so decimated, yes, of course everything would look so retro, I guess, wouldn't it?
Well,
you know,
I don't know.
People's spacesuits.
Those old Sugar Puffs adverts up everywhere. We've bombed London back to the 200 years, but they're all their old adverts showing up.
Earlier today, I think it's either Hayden or Mark, so I'm just watching the last film. He said, oh, here come the Robo-Men. And I remember saying, no, stop, don't say that. I cannot get that bloody Robo-Man march music out of my ear once it starts. It's really a worm. Stars in the film. Obviously, the big change here is, unfortunately, just as we were saying at the last film, Jill Curzon is always given less to do than Jenny Lindon was. And so it's again focused on Susan and Tom, and largely Wyler, I think. Actually, the big difference, I suppose, is they're all in different places, aren't they? All over the all over the country, all over the home counties, put it that way. I don't think I need to explain to everyone who Bernard Cribbins was. I think he was more, like we said, an actor version of Roy Castle. He was always on things like he'd make an appearance on the Generation Game, say, or he'd be in
The Avengers.
The Avengers, or what was that thing I was just thinking of?
The Wombles.
The good old days. He was always on that. Often with Roy Castle. You got the glorious Philip Maddock, who's in everything. Eileen Way, the old cow who betrays them, was...
Oh, and Sheila Steeple's the other one, isn't it?
Yeah. She was in Tribe of Gum. Eileen's one of the old crones in the cave. And she was Lady Adrasta's sidekick in Creature from the Pit.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Andrew Keir, who plays Wyler, Susan's bearded Scottish friend, was Professor Quatermass in Quatermass in the Pit in 1967. I love that one. And Ray Brooks, who played David, the sort of counterpart to Ian, went on to build himself a quite successful career doing voiceovers for children's and television. I had no idea that he was the voice of the Mr. Ben series.
Yes, he was.
Wow, that's amazing. It's not amazing, actually. It's I don't suppose it's that amazing at all.
As he walked back down Festive Road, Mr. Ben thought about his adventure. When he went to get his front door key out, he found an unusual box of matches in his pocket. He smiled at the picture on the box. How nice, he thought. I'll keep them carefully, just to remind me.
Was he in Kathy Come Home as well? The Ken Loach film.
He was in, I think he's quite a 60s...
Let's have a look.
Pop culture figure, isn't he?
Oh, he was. He was. Yeah.
Because he was also in That'll Be the Day with David Essex, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah, he was in Kathy Come Home, which was broadcast 16th of November 1966. So he must have filmed that not long after he finished filming this film, then. Filming this film, that's terrible English.
And if you weren't that taken with the plot, you could just sort of watch the posters, couldn't you? Famously.
Oh, glorious.
The film was co-financed by a promotional deal with Sugar Puffs for on-screen product placement. And I mean, you can't look anywhere without big Sugar Puffs posters, can you? It's not the... Perhaps when we go to Capitol next year, maybe instead of wearing Do Not Dump Bodies in the River t-shirts, we should wear Sugar Puffs t-shirts.
Oh, go dressed as the Honey Monster.
Yeah, well, I already am. But Sugar Puffs had a packet promotion placement. I'm not quite sure which is the more outrageous, the product placement on this film or in the Bond franchise.
Oh, God.
Rolex? Omega. Oh. Tell them about the honey, mummy. There's posters everywhere, aren't there? There's, and you can't often tell whether they are actually product placement or they're just set decoration. There's a poster called Lo que el viento se llevó, which I think is just Spanish for Gone with the Wind. And you think, well, that came out in 1936. So I'm not sure why they'd be advertising it in 1966, let alone 2150. You've got Air India, Buffalo Bill's Circus, Del Monte Peaches. This took me back. Harp, the new blonde lager. Stay sharp.
Harp, stay sharp to the bottom of the glass. Harp, stay sharp.
Oh, Harp. I know Harp.
Of course, there's one poster that's missing from the film version of this.
Tell all.
Perhaps Terrence Dix can come on at the end and remind us.
Oh, yes, of course. Well done, said. Mark, yes.
What's this?
Don't dump bodies in a river.
Oh, God. The Sugar Puffs also did a promotion on their packets of cereals, by the way. Once again, to win one of three life-size Daleks. For a chance of winning, readers had to look at a list of 13 qualities for fighting Daleks, and then pick the 6 that they thought would be most useful, putting them in order of importance. And in case of a tiebreak, they had to complete the sentence, I think Sugar Puffs would help me fight the Daleks because... ... in 10 words or less. And the options for the qualities of fighting Daleks were be able to imitate a Dalek voice, have a protective suit against Dalek ray guns, that sounds quite useful, carry emergency food and water pills for a week, know how to do first aid, be able to travel anywhere in space, have a knowledge of electronics, carry a radio to contact Earth from space, have resistance to brainwashing, that was H. Option I was know how to operate the TARDIS. And suddenly, for some reason, there's no J. It skips straight to K. be as clever as Doctor Who. Know how to tell other people what to do.
Hold on. Wasn't it in one of the Dalek annuals or something that the Daleks don't have a letter J in their alphabet? Am I gone mad?
There's quite an overlap, Mark. The two can be at the same time. That's a great... I won't record this because you get tired of me talking about Frasier. But there's a great episode of Frasier where a new person comes on as and one of the... to have a phone-in show. And she's the opposite of Frasier. She's like a shock jock. And someone rings in and says, I'm having trouble with my boyfriend.
All right, let's get right to our first caller. Whom do we have?
We have Jenny from Tacoma on line one.
Hello, Jenny. I'm Dr. Nora, and I'm here to help.
Hi, Dr. Nora. My boyfriend and I have been living together for about 2 years.
Are you having sex?
Our sex life's not the problem. It's great. But whenever I mention marriage, he changes the subject. Do you think that he's afraid of commitment?
No, that's not it. Let me help you see this from a different perspective. You're a whore, Jenny. You're sleeping with a man you're not married to. In my book, that's a whore.
Well, I'm not a whore. I'm a flight attendant.
Oh, you think there's no overlap? Wake up, Jenny. You have blown it. Dump this creep. Find a new guy, and until you're Mrs. New Guy, you keep those knees together, okay? Staple them. I don't care if you have to hop to the altar. God bless, honey. Who's next?
Oh, you think there's no overlap? That might become one of my catchphrases. Was that the same Doctor Who annual article where... they had things like...
they can't see the colour red or something.
A brindigulum is a meeting of five or more Daleks or something.
I think so, yeah.
And the final option was never panic when in danger. And so the top three won one of the actual props, Dalek props in the series. 500 runners-up were awarded a battery-operated toy model Dalek, one of the Louis Marx ones. And then I think there's umpteen other things, Daleks merchandise, that people, other runners-up would win. There's only one of the winners. His name is known. There's a picture somewhere in the Brighton Gazette or something of a young 10-year-old lad called John Streeter who won the Red Dalek. And he's sort of, he's photographed pushing it home.
Can I just say, last little thing, that both the movie posters for these films are absolutely stunning. And...
they're amazing, aren't they?
In the mid-noughties, there was a BT mobile campaign. I think it was BT Broadband, actually. It starred Daniel Rigby, who played, and I think he won the BAFTA for playing a young Eric Morecambe. And he was in this campaign, and in most of the ads from this campaign, it went on for a few years, they had the Doctor Who and the Daleks poster in the shot in their flat.
Links to all of this will, of course, be included in our show notes, which you can find on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com.
You may remember some years ago I chose the first Dalek movie as my rainy day choice.
Oh yes, of course.
And we had quite a good discussion of it then. And I think then I would have almost undoubtedly have wheeled out my brief anecdote that me and my good friend Dan, whose birthday is today, in fact, actually, happy birthday, Dan. Sometime in the 90s, we went to, definitely was the 90s actually. We went to a kind of village hall in Folkestone where they were showing on an old fashioned reel to reel projector both movies on the big screen. So we went along and we enjoyed the first film. The second film was made up of three reels. They put on reel one, no problem. Then they put on reel three, and then they put on reel two. So that was the order in which we watched the Dalek Invasion Earth 2150, which was just surreal, really. And they just went, well, sorry, but that's just, you know, there you are. But they did a raffle at the end, and my friend Dan won two posters. He won both the film posters, and he kept the Dalek Invasion of Earth one, and he gave me the Daleks one.
You still got it?
Yeah, it's not an original or anything like that. It's one that they've had printed themselves. But
is this Dan, father of Elliot?
Yes, it is, yes, yeah.
And you call me Jammy?
Well, I didn't win the raffle. It was my friend Dan who did. Oh, one of the things that I did when I was touring Whitstable with Stephen and doing the Peter Cushing tour was we stood on the same platform that I once saw Peter Cushing standing on myself when I was I was about 14 or 15. And I remember sitting, I was sat there, I saw this elderly gentleman stood on the platform. He's about 6 or 7 feet away from me, just standing there. I looked at him and thought, Jesus Christ, it's Peter Cushing. I just sat there staring. So this would have been, actually would have been probably late-ish 80s. And I just stared and stared. And I thought, I really should go up and say something to him because I'm never going to get this chance to tell him how much I love his films and stuff. And I thought, do you know? And I thought, no, because I'll get nervous and I'll get overexcited and I'll say something stupid. And besides, look, he's clearly an elderly gentleman who wants to catch the train and he doesn't need any of my crap today. Thank you very much. And I thought, no, I'm just going to sit here and stare at him for as long as I can whilst he can't notice. And to be honest, that is advice I should have taken when I saw Matthew Waterhouse stood at the bar in that first Capital. But that's a different story altogether.
I was just about to say that, actually. No, but I think that's being that respectful is just as nice a tribute as say. I quite frequently walk past quite famous people in the middle of London. Mm. If they see me looking at them, our eyes meet, I just smile and say hello. Not just hello as in, oh, hello, but hello as in, oh, hello, you're you, aren't you? And they just smile back and say hello. And I think, oh, if I was famous, unless I was one of these people who want to be famous just for the sake of it, I'd much prefer if people did that. Please don't come up to me.
Yeah. I had that with Jimmy Page at Paddington.
Who?
Jimmy Page.
Oh, Jimmy Page, of course.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, carrying a box of, I don't know, just junk, basically. But pushed through the turnstiles, coming the opposite direction to me. I looked at him and thought, I'm pretty sure that's Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin. And he looked at me and went and just gave me a big beaming smile and carried on his way. And I was like, oh, it was Jimmy Page.
To launch the release of these two new remastered 4K upgrade films, of course, they had a special screening at the BFI in the South Bank in London, with a panel including Roberta Tovey, Jill Curzon, and also Sir Guy Subotsky, obviously the son of the screenwriter Milton. And he revealed that his father, although I think what we know now is the second film wasn't anything like as successful as the first, so they never made the third film. He revealed that his father did actually pen the screenplay for a third adventure, although not until 15 years had elapsed. But that may have been a good thing, because apparently the script he prepared was called Doctor Who's Greatest Adventure, which was actually a repurposed script of a horror film called King Crab.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, there's no such thing as crab.
The original title was even worse, Night of the Crabs.
That's a Guy N. Smith book, isn't it?
With two doctors, a young doctor and an old doctor. But for me, to sum up with both films, I think they're quite like Star Wars in a way, in that there's no use watching them to be enthused by the drama or the plot or the acting. They are very much audio and visual spectaculars. I think the highlight of both movies is the look and the sound of them. Some great soundtrack music on the first film. Wonderful colour palettes. And that's all I've got to say. So, if no one else has got anything more to say, shall we give them marks out of 10?
Yeah, how are we doing this? Because I can't...
We can't really, can we? Because what are we comparing them to?
It's difficult because they're their own thing. And I can't... With the Doctor Who's, I've got a way of gauging...
Yeah.
You know, or feeling like, oh, this is probably what I gave so-and-so, so I'll give this shall that not, in relation then? To that. Well, I don't know, because in a way, my heart wants to just give them both a nice 9 out of 10, just because they're not perfect, but they give me a lot of pleasure.
Well, I can compartmentalise them a little easier than that, I think. Okay. I can actually say, I'd give Doctor Who and the Daleks 7 out of 10. This is for what they are. I'm not comparing them against their TV counterparts or the rest of it.
However you want to do it.
As films, I would say 7 out of 10 for the first one. And I probably would I would say 9 out of 10 for Dalek Invasion of Earth.
I'd probably say 9 for the first one, maybe 8 for the second one. Although that's not comparing to anything really. Oh, who's this? It's my uncle Terence. Have you come to make some comment on the set dressing of the second Doctor Who film?
Yes, I am, my dear physician. Unfortunately, there was a poster of imperative importance that was missing in Dalek Invasion of Earth 2150 AD.
I'm sure there was. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, though.
What should the poster have said, dear Uncle Terence?
It should have said, my dear Doc, don't dump bodies in the river. But instead it was talking about bloody sugar puffs.
Uncle Terence, we have Dalek spaceships in the Body Stealers in 1969.
It's a reused prop.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye. Bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dumb Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumbpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydumb, on Twitter at diddly_dumb, or email us at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dumb, the empty space that circles time.